Can you hear me? Is it okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, I wanted to talk a bit about saddlebags, because we see in the TV all the time where people eat on the trail, and we know that men existed for years from what they could carry on the back of a saddle or in a pack on a mule or wherever. Men spent their whole lives living out of that kind of food. And as a child, I had the idea that food that was made into a lunch was delicious, because when I'd sit alongside my mama as she prepared the lunches for the youngsters in the family who went down to the country school, nothing, it looked to me, but ambrosia itself went into that food, because there would be deviled eggs and there would be the best cookies and there would be sandwiches made with delicious meat contents, and I just thought that there was nothing in this world that could be so tasty and so good as school lunches. And then when the older ones of the family would come home, and I would dig into those saddlebags, and once in a while there'd be a cookie left, or once in a while there'd be a sandwich left, my disillusionment was always there, because leather makes things smell, and leather makes things taste. And those bits of food, which should have been just the most delicious in the world, were beyond eating. And that was probably by 5 o'clock in the afternoon of the day they were made. And I've often thought about the food that men lived on for years. They talk about jerky. Have you ever eaten jerky? Well, it takes an awful lot of imagination to make it anything but just something to hold soul and body together. The same with dried corn. Yuck! The same with the bacon and beans and all of that stuff. How would they have time to cook beans long enough over a campfire to make them digestible? I know that in sheep camps, where they had a little more permanent place to live, and where there was a chance to carry food from place to place with perhaps a wagon or a pack mule or something, that sheep herders would make their dough biscuits or dough gods or whatever they call them in the top of their sacks of flour. And this was done by opening the sack and hollowing out a little mound and putting into it a little saleratus. This is what was the pioneer name for soda. And then they'd put in a little sour milk, maybe, or maybe just water, and a little grease, and mix it up in enough flour so that that would get into a soft ball. And then they would cook it over the campfire in the grease left from frying their bacon or frying their ham or frying their rabbit or whatever it was they fried. But they had to have a little fat to do this. And since rabbit has very little fat on it, or any of the fowl that they would kill, like prairie chickens or whatever, grouse or whatever, pheasant, whatever would be around. And there weren't many pheasants until they were imported, of course. Why, I've often thought about the fare which they lived on. It was very, very meager, and you had to be a hungry man out in the open who didn't want to starve to death to relish it very much, I'm sure. So that's what I wanted to say about the fare and the food of the early day settler in this area. Also, I might add that in the winter, unless one had a deep pit or hilled things over outside with a straw and earth, there wasn't much chance of keeping them from freezing, which meant that your diet in the winter was meat, potatoes, and gravy, and that was it. And you were lucky if you got the potatoes through. Many times it'd have to be meat, biscuits, and gravy. Well, of course, if you're exercising a great deal, you can live on that and be healthy and do just fine. But the limited diets were hard on people who didn't have the capacity to digest them. Then the other thing we wanted to talk about was early day politics. Well, of course, the national news percolated out here via newspaper and the telegraph, etc. And my family was split by the silver populists. My father was one, and my mother remained staunchly Republican. But Dad voted for William Jennings Bryan, and I don't think Mother did. However, when Election Day came, no matter how pressing the homework was and what they were in the midst of doing, they got into their better clothes, got into the wagon, and went to vote. Election Day was sacred to voting. And their opinions were very often discussed in front of us children. Whenever there was a gathering with Grandfather and Grandmother Jane, particularly, there was lots of talk. And our folks were staunch Republicans because Grandfather, being an immigrant from Switzerland, had had to make up his mind about this democracy and how far he was going to go with it. Well, his father had made immense sacrifice to bring him here, along with his numerous family. And then the Civil War engulfed Granddad, who fought in a regiment from Wisconsin along with two of his brothers. And never to him was there any deviation from the side of the Republican, which to him was the true party of democracy. He always voted, and so did my father, for many years, at the little circle which was provided on the ballot at the top of the ticket. And that circle, if you put an X in it, meant that you voted for all of the candidates in that party who were named beneath the circle. My father had to leave this practice, however, though, one time when a friend of his named Jim Kane ran for sheriff. Jim was a Democrat, but he was such a good man, and Dad was so respectful of him, he had to split his ticket. And that was the first time I ever heard of a heresy like that, I can tell you. This was probably along in the late teens or early 20s. Politics were always brought out in that on every stock show, 4th of July, or any other big picnic where people gathered and there was any kind of a parade, and they had a parade at the drop of a hat, the old soldiers always had special conveyance. In the early times, I remember it, it was in a nicely decorated wagon. Then later, it was in a two-heated hack, and later then in an open car. And those old gentlemen, Mr. Cambidge, Mr. Ryan, Mr. Hollister, Mr. Roderick, Mr. Jane, those were the ones that were always there. Then there were others that from time to time came along. But those were the gentlemen who had fought in the Civil War and belonged to the Grand Army of the Republic. And their women were in the auxiliary. Of course, at the time I came along, they were all very old people in their 70s. So there wasn't a great deal of activity, and their women mostly were dead by that time. But those old gentlemen would totter along on their canes and be boosted up into those vehicles, and down the street they would go, their hats set firmly upon their brows, all of them in uniform, dark blue with big broad-brimmed black Stetson hats. And they were proud, and we were proud of them. Let's see, that's enough on politics. Then let's talk about, I wanted to talk about an early pioneer, and this is hearsay entirely from my parents. But my grandfather broke a great deal of sod in this area. This was the first time that the plow was ever inserted in the surface of this surrounding territory. And it was a terrific task, and it took immense strength on the part of the team that pulled the vehicle, though it was just a one-burner plow. That sod was so heavy, and the earth to which the roots were clinging was so black and heavy and solid that it took immense strength to pull that metal affair through this resisting medium. Grandfather had good oxen and he had good horses, but he also employed the horses of old Kentuck, who was a character. He used the wild horses of this horse man for the breaking of them. In other words, he'd go down to the river where the man lived at the mouth of the Hatway Creek and bring home wild stock, which Grandfather used the following season and brought them back in the fall as a seasoned team, which of course meant that this service was of exceeding value to Kentuck, and at the same time gave Grandfather the horse flesh to do the job he was doing. In breaking this sod, there was an amusing sidelight in that my father, who was just a little boy, 11, 12, and so forth, had his tender heart touched by the plight of the little prairie chickens. They would be disturbed in their nesting area by the encroachment of the plow. And as the plow moved with its furrow, the little birds would try to go over this furrow back to where they belonged, near the nest, and they would get plowed under. And my father would run with his little old bare feet in there and pick them up and take them to the edge of the plowed surface. But before he could get back with his next load of little birds, they would be crawling back over these furrows to find their former home and get plowed under. He said the prairie chickens were so numerous that they made a stack of hay look gray with their feathers. And they were a main staple of diet, this excellent fowl. Plump from the grain, plump from the seeds, plump from the good food that was around. They were very fine eating. Dad used to shoot them, too, for food. Never was wanting shooting done unless it was for varmint. But for food, my father was a great gleaner. And he had as his weapon an old muzzle loader of Granddad's. And he'd cock it between the toes of his bare front foot. And only a child could have done this. And then he would lean back, and with that foot as a rest, he would shoot the gun, which would kick terribly. But the aim would be accurate, because the kick didn't come till after the shot was fired. And Dad could bring down a prairie chicken every shot. But to go back to Kentuck, his name actually was John Talent, as I understand it, and he was a remittance man, a very fine family from Kentucky. So, since he was not talking a great deal about his antecedents, people called him Old Kentuck. Old didn't mean that he was old in years, it just meant that he was a familiar person and someone whom everyone recognized by being called Kentuck, so it was Old Kentuck. He was a single man when I first heard of him, and he pretty well cornered the pinto ponies that the Nez Perce squaws had in the area. Just how he acquired them is somewhat cloudy, but he did get the majority of these animals in his possession and sold them to people who were coming through to settle, to homestead, and to make their place in this area. When their moving stock, you want to close that door? When their moving stock was weary or ill or whatever, his place was a source of supply. And one day to his place came a man and wife, and I don't know how many, but more than one child. And they stayed there, camped there a day or two, and the man took off and abandoned his wife and children. She stayed on and became housekeeper for Kentuck. And, of course, she was not a divorced woman, and she sorely needed shelter. And so in due time, they had children. I don't know how many, but more than one. And since there was great disgrace to illegitimate children at this time, this was a very heart-sore situation. But of course, her husband was living, but was someplace, and of course, alive, they assumed. So there was no divorce, and divorce was not common then anyway. The courts were not numerous, and the courts were not at hand. And so pioneer measures often crossed the lines of the law. He left his children. One was named Peter Dick, who died when he was just a little boy. Kentuck mourned deeply for this child. And he was always known as Peter Dick because they couldn't put a surname to his little moniker. He was buried up above the family home on the point of the hill to the south of the opening of the Hatway Creek. And in due time, when Kentuck died, he was buried beside his little boy. Another family came along, and there was a widower with children. And I don't know whether Kentuck had died by this time or not, but the woman involved was still around with her two families. And for some reason, probably because they got word that the first husband had died, she was able to marry this widower. And together they had one more child. Marriage took place another place in this family because a daughter of the first family and a son of the widower were married. They were no blood relation, of course, of any kind. And they were a wonderful family who have descendants presently all in over this area. Wonderfully respected, good people, to which there is no cloud of anything in their background. These tangles occurred because of the lack of the convenience of arranging legality and in the face of pioneer necessity. Each union that this woman was a party to, she was faithful to her partner during that time. She was an honorable woman and a deeply loved woman, though this very tangled background was there. And some of her children squirm about it presently, but they shouldn't, because she was a fine person. Now, what else was I going to talk to? Oh, I wanted to talk about Timothy Driscoll, our town's most eminent citizen. He was a man of money and a dear, dear person. His wife was a woman of culture, and they held themselves to a high standard of living. There was always good literature in their home, a gracious table, and an interest in opera, Shakespeare, and the best of whatever came to the area, or whatever they could encourage to come to the area. Mr. Driscoll was the richest man, and he did many things up and down Main Street that no one ever knew about that were kind and helpful to people in the community. For example, at graduation time from high school, and this was a great big deal because many people didn't go on to school after high school, Mr. Driscoll usually gave a present, a well-chosen present, to every graduate. His daughter, Edna, took on the social responsibility later in Mr. Driscoll's life, and carried on with the strength and character which he and his wife showed. His wife was rarely seen because she was mostly at home in very handsome clothing in her lovely home, but not a person to invite in a lot of people or to ever accept an invitation. But she was recognized as the community intellectual leader. Mr. Driscoll's land is still owned by Edna, who has been a wonderful custodian of the estate. She is now a woman in her 90s, living in Lewiston, and whether she'd be capable of an interview or not is a question, but her mind has been wonderful always. She never married. Her younger sister, Dorothy, did. She married a man named Pond, down in from the southern Idaho Ponds, a fine old family there. Their marriage ended along the way, I don't know why, and finally Dorothy died in a nursing home in Gooding, Idaho. She is buried in the family plot and the Genesee Catholic Cemetery, where in due time, I'm sure, Edna plans to be placed beside her father and mother. Mr. Driscoll was in partnership with Fred Hampton for many years, and the Hampton-Driscoll holdings were extensive. At the time of Mr. Hampton's death, the estate or holdings were divided, so that there was then the Hampton holdings and the Driscoll holdings in separate condition. I want to talk about the Follets. Pioneer merchants, farmers first and then merchants in the area, we revolved around Follett's store as a center of merchandise. They sold everything from a spool of thread to a cookie with coconut on top that so enticingly was in the drawer of cookies with a glass in front to make a little girl's mouth just drool at its beauty and its known deliciousness. They had some clerks that were as well known as the store and the family of Follett. One of them was Jim Jackson. He was superintendent of the public, of the Sunday school, and his teeth weren't in very good shape, but I can remember Mr. Jackson standing up in front of our community church. At that time, it was the Congregational Church Sunday School, and singing with gusto the wonderful old hymns, his bay window crossed by a gold chain with a fob on it, his hymnal, red of cover, held in his hand, and his singing an unbridled joy. He was great in the store. He never let a customer leave without a tiny little sly gift. Many times that cherished and longed for cookie to a little girl. I don't know whether he made a lot of money for the Folletts because of these numerous gifts, but they were never very big. They were mainly just an effort at public relations because he liked everybody and he wanted them to feel good and to come back. And of course they always did. As I said the other day, the grocery bill was paid once a year, and so the books had to be kept over a very long time. But after all, income came once a year when a crop was sold. So this was the custom and the way it was done. Some of the Folletts are still living in Genesee. And as a matter of fact, the last man to own the Follett store was Malin, grandson of the founder. His father was George, and he is a fine man, and I hope you get to interview him. I think he would be able to give you an excellent interview, Malin Follett. They were dear friends of my folks, the Janes, and I can remember that Mrs. George Follett's cookies at the Sunday school picnics were the best sour cream sugar covered delectables that a little girl ever had a chance to to eat, and her mother-in-law, Mrs. John Follett Sr., made a handmade handkerchief as a birthday present for my grandmother Adelia Jane, which was so beautiful that grandmother never used it. And so, after nearly 100 years had gone by, I found this treasure with the note as to what it was, and gave it to the great, great granddaughter of the Creator on the occasion of her wedding, and she carried it for her wedding. Her name was Johnny Sue Brown, and she loved it. Now, I forget the name of the man she married. But the little remembrance of all that generations of loving friends and neighbors was kept alive in this way. The Folletts were good farmers. Fred Follett was a businessman and wound up in business on the coast. He was a moneymaker, too. Then there was a dentist. There was Leon Follett, who carried on the grocery store, and along with his brother George. Leon Follett sang in the congregational choir. He sang for my father's funeral. He was a bass and very faithful to going to church, which was certainly a warm neighborhood center. My grandfather, Lewis Jane, gave the Bible to this church, and I found it when I was a teenager. And by the time I was enough aware of history and the passage of time and what happens to things to preserve that Bible, I couldn't find it. So we don't have it. But it was getting pretty dog-eared and had been used so very much, so very long, and it was large and unwieldy. So I'm sure that it went the way of all flesh. The early people in the Congregational Church were surely dedicated, and through the years they missed few services. This was the same with the church a block away, where the Methodists gathered, and another one a block further down the hill, where the Christians gathered. And certainly the faithful on the hill to the west that went to the Catholic Church, the same family names still are there. And then just diagonally across the street was the German Lutheran Church, which now is combined with the Norwegian Lutheran Church as one congregation. But German was spoken in both the Catholic and the Lutheran sermons, and Norwegian or Swedish or whatever was spoken in the Lutheran church, which earlier always took place in the services did, always took place in the Genesee Valley Church, still a viable institution, where families come home from afar to be buried with those who loved them. And where, wonder of wonders, the tombstone markers have been kept in symmetrical, surveyor's straight lines, the only cemetery with such exactitude that I have seen. And now that we have the flat markers, it's not so important. But when you go out of the doorway of the Valley Lutheran Church, you don't see a mishmash of stones. You see a nice row up the hill diagonally so that all is in order. It was done as a labor of love, I am sure. The Church of the Catholics, with their chimes, which were taken from the church after a big fire, ruled our lives. We didn't wake up in the morning until the 6 o'clock bell had chimed. We ate dinner at noon by the 12 o'clock bell, and we had a bite of supper at night with the 6 o'clock bell. There were higher and lower tones of bells, but the main one that chimed the hours absolutely ruled our lives. And how glad we were to have them. Why, it made sense to a little girl playing off someplace. There was the Catholic bell. Better get home. And that's the way we lived. The whole town lived by those bells. And we just loved them. We weren't conscious of it. This was just part of life. There was a school bell, too. And then there was a fire bell. And that fire bell had the most awful clang. When it would wake you out of a sound sleep in the middle of the night, you would just practically jump out of your skin. Burned. All you hoped for was to keep neighboring structures from catching. And that was the first time in my life that I remember trembling with fear or the nervous tension of great unease. I remember trembling that night, and ever after, the sound of that fire bell was even more terrifying. And on my piano, I picked out two notes when played together that made the same relative sound as that bell. And I would sometimes play that sound in as I was killing time and was just a little kid around, just to see if I could make the same terrifying sound. Of course, I knew it wasn't the same thing, but it still made me very uncomfortable. Aren't kids funny? And those were the bells in my life and in the life of the whole community. Of course, Genesee's fire fighting equipment was all volunteer, which it still is, which Moscow's is. There isn't a paid fire department in the county. Lewiston's a little bit bigger, and it has paid firemen. But regularly employed people were somewhat contemptuous of men who worked for the fire department because it was such a lazy life, a long time between fires. But you had to have a fireman and a skilled person for his job when the time came. But this business of having a volunteer fire department has worked exceedingly well in our area. We have rural and urban, and they really are highly skilled. They have their own drills. They have very fine equipment, and they're Johnny on the spot. It's amazing if you have a fire how fast those people get to you and what a lot they can get accomplished in a hurry. Now, what else were we going to talk about?
Well, you were going to talk about Ed Vanook.
Oh, I couldn't talk about my childhood in Genesee without Ed Vanook. Bless his dear old tobacco-chewing face. It's just right in front of me. He was the oldest child of a widow who later had married a man and had many children by a man named Springer. But he was one of two children named Vanook. Three. There was Ed, and there was Pearl, who was the nurse who told me about the child with rabies. And there was Jake, who was the family of people still living in Genesee. Ed never married. He was the support of the family, though his mother had a very, very fine boarding house where everybody went to eat. And Ed and his mother were a great team to raise these younger children. Ed had the dray. Ed took the tickets at the shows. Ed took the tickets at the local baseball field. Ed took the tickets for the high school games. Ed would get dressed up with every badge he owned on his coat and go and faithfully serve the community. And he was greatly loved and appreciated, though considered just a little bit simple. I don't know that Ed was simple. I think, really, Ed just had never had a chance to go to school because he was earning and helping to feed the family when a very small little boy. But his mother was a great cook and wonderful character. She loved her kids, and by the time she got the baby of her family, and he, with a good voice, there was time for him to have a few music lessons and a little grace in life. So I couldn't possibly talk about Genesee without mentioning Ed. He lived to a very old age and was tenderly cared for in the home of this younger half-brother, Marky Springer.
I was going to say the Decoration Day was something
else. Yes, that was something else. I wanted to say that one of the few homesteaders I ever saw in my life was Bill Springer, an older half-brother of Ed Fanuc. And he had a very small holding of tillable land and the rest in canyon land bordering my father's place down on the Rim Rock. And Bill Springer built a little house which he had on the corner near my father's townhouse, and which Dad later bought and moved over next door to our front porch to house my mother's aunt, who had come from Michigan to homestead and to live with her brother and his wife, and after their deaths had moved to Genesee and lived in the little house which Bill Springer built. That little house presently is the bunkhouse down on Dad's place, having been moved there. So it still would serve were anyone of a mind to use it, though it's been vacant now since the renter doesn't need it. I was going to talk about what did you say?
Decoration Day.
Oh, Decoration Day was a big day for everybody. And on that day, many times, old soldiers wore their uniforms. And then after World War II, there were men in uniforms who played taps and shot their guns on Decoration Day to honor the war dead. And everybody else honored their loving memories of their dead. And there probably weren't bouquets that were domestically grown on 1 out of 10 graves at the cemeteries, but there were wildflowers in abundance, and they were put there in fruit jars or in cans, though this came later because we didn't have many cans when I was real small. But the flowers often were just laid lovingly on the top of the graves. Everybody took the day off and went to town in their very best and met for whatever ceremony there was. Perhaps the preacher said a few words, perhaps a politician was invited in, or the mayor of the town spoke and there'd be a gathering. And then everyone would go to the cemetery either before or after this town occasion. And then there'd be dinners in relatives' homes all over the place, because Decoration Day was one where you paid attention. My grandmother's two little girls had died, one of them in childbirth and one of them at 15 with spinal meningitis. They were beautiful little girls. And always in grandmother's bedroom were the two pictures side by side. This was a crushing blow to the whole family, because they died November, December, January, February, March. They died within 5 months of each other. And they were so well known in the community. And my wedding occurred just 40-odd years from the wedding of the little older girl who died in childbirth. Her husband was Dr. W.C. Cox, a pioneer physician in the area, and the wedding was very formally done with white gloves on the ushers and white silk ties, and in the museum presently are my father's pair of white gloves and his cravat from being an usher at his sister's wedding. The reception was held downtown, and everyone was invited. This was a very important social occasion. And my wedding, which occurred all these many years later, was in the church and was also attended by numerous people. The church was full. And we didn't have a reception for everybody. We just had a family and close friend dinner. Fried chicken from the beginning to the end of all that fried chicken dinners mean in Genesee. And we just had it for 52. Dr. Cox was one of the very first physicians in the area, and for his wife to have to die in childbirth was a cruel irony. He was a most interesting man. He graduated from Jefferson Medical School about 1886, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe it was 1882. It was early. I went to Jefferson on a trip one time, and they were very wonderful to me and took me all over the place, including the old operating room where he had learned his skills. This was before the day of anesthesia, and the boards of the operating table were on either side with chains hanging down because the patient had to be chained to endure the agony of being cut in that way without anesthesia. The heartfelt care of whole families by family physicians was an important part of pioneer life. And Dr. Cox was a deeply respected person as a family physician. However, as time went by, he moved to Everett, Washington to practice, and it was there that his wife died. And, cruelest blow of all, she died of puerperal fever, which means somewhere in her care there was someone or something that was not sterilized. They didn't know. Pasteur had not discovered germs at that time. And doctors, midwives, and nurses were not always careful to wash their hands because they didn't know that it did any particular harm for a physician to go from one person to another. And little Grace died of puerperal fever, and so did her baby. And they lie together, side by side, in a row, Adelia and Lewis, Grace and her little boy, Carrie, and then Walter and my father and my mother, Leela. They are in a row in the Genesee Cemetery. Before I leave the subject of cemetery, where I expect to lie one day, just a little west of my family's plot, there is a tall shaft there for Wallace Coole, the husband of Marie Nebelsick. He was the deputy sheriff shot on the streets of Moscow when the man named Steffens went berserk and killed Dr. Watkins. This tragedy is written as a central theme in the book Buffalo Coat by Carol Ryrie Brink. And Wallace Coole rests in the cemetery at Genesee. Alongside him is his sister-in-law, Emma, a delightful Nebelsick daughter who used to visit my family and who was a charming and lovely person. She married rather late in life, a man over in Oregon, and in due time walked into the river and took her life. So two tragedies in the Nebelsick family occurred, And the two people involved lie there side by side near the Jane and the Wicks plots. There's another plot right beside it for the Hollisters. Mr. Hollister was a G.A.R. and owned the Genesee Hotel and raised a family there. His sister-in-law, Lena Favor, owned the building in which I now sit at one time, together with her husband. They were a pioneer family, Mrs. Favor and Mrs. Hollister's maiden name was Camp, and they came of very fine people. The Hollister graves are distinguished by a tombstone with a sweet little dog on it. That is to their dog, an Airedale named Don, and the tombstone reads, "Don, our faithful friend." Because one time Mrs. Hollister got lost over on a homestead near the Camas Prairie as she went to get the family cow down in the canyon. She lost her way and they couldn't find her all night. And it rained just a bit, and she would have died if it hadn't been that she was protected from exposure by the fact that Don, their dog, nestled in her lap and kept her warm. So Don, I remember as we would walk by to go to school, was a very old and deeply loved pet. And he lies right beside at the foot of Mr. and Mrs. Hollister. There is just a bit east, the Wall plot, and this is a large area in which the twins are buried that my grandmother helped bring into the world and fed their mother the little cordial made of Oregon grape jelly. They lie there, and the brother Sherman, who told my father of his sad financial prediction, which proved to not be correct, and his wife, Mary Wall. She was a Moscow pioneer, Mary McFarland, one of the first graduates of the University of Idaho, a marvelous woman. She was a bit old when they had their children because she married a little later in life, which was perhaps why her first child was a spastic and could not walk by himself. And I remember so many times seeing Mrs. Wall with her son Kellis held with her two arms under his arms, her hands clasped across his little chest, his two feet resting on her feet as she brought him in to the opera house for plays or graduations or whatever the occasion was. She was a beautiful woman and so devoted to her child. She had a slow and difficult birth, and my mother always said that the doctor became panicky and took Kellis, which resulted in the damage that caused his spasticity. He was intelligent, and he kept the books of the family farming business, but at age about 32, he tipped himself from his wheelchair into the farmyard watering trough and took his life. He had very fine brother and sister, one of whom, the man of whom, is on the staff at WSU at this time. A most substantial citizen of our area who's married to the sister, the baby of the family, of Lola Clyde. The baby of the Gamble family, that is. And of course their father was the first Presbyterian minister here, as fine an Irish gentleman as ever was. I heard of him one time that when there was a smallpox epidemic, Daniel Gamble was the person who went from stricken household to stricken household and helped everyone and remained immune from the disease. He was truly a Christian man. So the family spread, and family mingles with family. And east of the wall plot is that of the Bresslers. Dear, wonderful people. Grandmother Bressler was a distinguished lady from Kentucky, and she came west with money. And her son, Fred Bressler, was the local banker that I knew during my early years as the banker. He had an affliction on his hand, which still is in the family strain. Some of the fingers were not separated from each other. And I remember how strange his hand looked as he wrote with a pen at the bank window, but with what a flowing, beautiful script he produced. He had three children and a wife who was the daughter of Newton Hollister, whom I've just spoken about, who honored his pet. Bertha Hollister was Mrs. Fred Bressler. I can remember sitting on Mr. Bressler's lap and eating some of Mrs. Bressler's delicious divinity candy, which made my fingers a little sticky. And I remember asking Mr. Bressler why his fingers were the way they were, and playing with his hand, putting it up to my cheek, because I loved him. And he said, with the sweetest tone, he said, "Why, Gracie, when I was little, I ate divinity candy, and my hands got sticky, and you know I did it so often, and my mama didn't wash it very carefully, and you know they just grew like that." And so he passed off my, what could have been a hurtful episode, because he was so mature and so kind. Mrs. Bressler was a very individual woman. She outlived her husband, though she was always ill a great deal. She inherited the large family estate and eventually lived with her daughter Adeline, the youngest of the family, in Spokane. Don Bressler was the first man I kissed, because he was the man in the play where I hated to to be involved. Alas, his life was somewhat wasted, because while still in his 30s, he became ill from alcoholism and became a heartbreaking figure beyond help for those of us who loved him and so wished to keep his great worth. He had been a captain in World War I. He had been in business with his father in the bank. He had married one of the Mullally girls, Irene, a delightful belle of the town, and they had one child who presently lives in Genesee. His descendants are still with us and wonderful people. If we only knew then what we know now about Alcoholics Anonymous, there was no reason to lose Don. These were family friends. In speaking of Genesee, I should also speak of the Larrabee family. Mr. Larrabee had the store that was down the street from Follett's one block. It, too, had a delicious smell of all the goodies that you could get there, and you could buy everything. Mr. Larrabee was married to a woman whose maiden name had been Wells, and the Wells family was numerous in the area also. The Larrabee children were numbered four, three girls and a boy. They all were handsome people and prominent in community life. The kind of people who had the leads in plays and were valedictorians and were the most sought after dates and went far away to live and had nice lives. Someone else I should speak about when talking of Genesee is the Burr family and the Gray families, but I'll speak, and the Wardrobes. I'll speak first of the Burrs. W.W. Burr was the community record keeper. He was a notary public. He was the town clerk. He did title business, eventually sold insurance, and he had a little office where people could get intellectual chores done and legal chores done of this nature. He had a nice family, and his wife was a prominent Rebecca. Their home was open to warm hospitality, and their daughter, Laura, was a lovely singer. She sang at both my father's and mother's funerals, and was a dearly loved companion, and still presently lives in the back of what used to be the Bressler Bank, and what eventually was her husband's place of business, because her husband, Bill Burr, followed in his father's footsteps in this same kind of clerical business. And Laura lives there to this day. The Grays were two farmers, William and Robert. William never married. And they were both money makers, very successful farmers. Robert Gray, Bob, had 10 children, of which there are so few descendants of the name that you can hardly believe it. Just two. There were other grandchildren, but their name was not Gray. Bob and Bill Gray were half-brothers of a man named Andrew Wardrobe, who had 14 children, and there are an amazingly few people named Wardrobe who lived to carry on the name. As a matter of fact, I only know one. So of all these many sons in 24 descendants, I think I can name just three, two Grays and one Wardrobe. This is the way life goes. Now, the women of the family, the daughters, had children, but of course their names were lost because of our way of just carrying on the male name. If I'm a woman's liver, it's certainly in that. Because many times in a woman's obituaries, you have to read clear to the end and hope that you find a brother of the woman involved, because only then do you find out who she was. To me, this is hurtful and a little shameful. It should not be. But the long hyphenated name that the Europeans have, of course, to brisk Americans would seem silly. But in only that way is a woman's identity preserved. The Grays inherited from Uncle Bob, they inherited from their father. They were good custodians, and they have inherited from each other. And two or three of them are very wealthy people who had no children. The next generation, Robert, has no children. The present generation, Charlie, has one. Lester had two, of which one died early in life. And now there is Cecil, who never married. Jesse never married. Albert never married. Oh, family, just let me finish by saying that they were wonderful people. And one time I had a delightful interlude with Mrs. Linehan, pioneer, Mrs. Wardrobe, pioneer, and my grandmother. Now, this was before I ever went to school, because those three ladies of an evening went down to Smoltz and had a soda. And I tell you, this was unheard, and they laughed and had the most fun about how silly they were being to go off for a little treat in the evening time. I bet they didn't do that twice in their whole lives, but they just felt gay as could be. Probably some husbands were busy someplace, maybe at IOOF Lodge or something, but away we went, and I got to go, and it was just super. Mrs. Wardrobe was a lovely person, as was Mrs. Linehan. Now, I want to talk about the scarcity of water. To find a good spring was exceedingly important. The artesian spring that bubbles forth at the Hanson place was known the whole country over, and it still does it right now to this minute. There's just a metal circle around it to a trough, but that spring has never ceased to bubble forth winter and summer, day and night, since this country was first seen by man, so far as I know. And nothing has ever been made of it. It's on the property presently of John Ludke, south of Genesee, and it just bubbles forth. But for any man on his homestead to find a good source of water was most important. On my father's place, down where I was born, this proved to be a very difficult matter. The spring that was just below the house and was carefully protected from any runoff of any kind in due time failed, or in the summertime would somewhat dry up, so that we had to go to another spring in a cove over in the field to the south. This was a great nuisance, because it meant that the men had to take horses and time, two big barrels on a stone boat, and go over and dip the water out, carry it back, and then we women had to dip it out of the barrels and take it in for domestic use. This took all kinds of time, which already was needed four ways for Sunday, and but we had it to do. And since during World War I, I was a growing girl around there, I had a gallon pail that was my vehicle, and I went out to that barrel, which had a piece of oilcloth over the top and a hoop down over the oilcloth to keep anything from entering, and I dipped the water out and took it in for Mother's tea kettle, Mother's water bucket, or Mother's reservoir. And this is the way we lived. I used to go as just for fun over when the water was gathered from the spring, because as the stone boat went along, its flat wooden runners left smooth marks in the plowed or harrowed field or in the dust of the road. And since I was usually barefooted, it was such a pleasure to walk on that nice smooth surface. And I'd hop along from flat place to flat place and just have a ball. Coming back, it wasn't as much fun, because I had to dodge the wet places where there'd be mud, because the barrels always sloshed a bit. In due time, when my brother lived on this place, Lou, he had to try to enlarge the spring or get water down below it. And he used dynamite and then would go down and dig. And this was a very nauseating, miserable thing to have to do. But he tried his best to get water close to the house in that way, but never succeeded. So my dad had to buy a spring north of us from some of the Connor place, which by that time was owned by Hampton Driscoll. And they sold him 80 acres, which is part of the present holding. And that way we got a good source, a steady source of water, which was piped down to the dwelling and then piped on down the hill to the corral for the stock. Water on the Jane homestead, where grandfather came, was also at a premium. That was a drilled well in due time, which had a motor to raise the water. It still just went into buckets outside, however, and was carried indoors until about World War II. When you're using water that comes that painfully, believe me, you're careful of it, and it goes from one use to another insofar as you are able. My parents were very conscious of this, and whereas my mother and sister were as saving of it as possible, but they never overused it, which some of the neighbors did, having a little greasy water to use to mop the floor or something like that.